Spring Suite. So please do join me, same time, 9 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this week by Neil Miners.
In the run-up to Red Nose Day across the BBC, Radio 3 hands over the airwaves to Simon Russell Beale in the guise of five great Baroque composers.
I have heard all your Baroque shows, Bach,
lots of kids,
Lully.
If he is not careful, he's going to have an accident. Oh. Isn't that Paul on the ground so near his tootsies?
We should be so lucky.
Purcell.
Purcell.
Oh, whatever.
His Dido and Aeneas was particularly well regarded.
It's what?
It's an opera.
The Baroque through the eyes and ears of some of Britain's top comic talents. Beastly Baroque, part of Baroque Spring on Radio 3. Weekdays next week at 5:30 in Tune and throughout the day on Red Nose Day, this Friday the 15th of March.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's just turned 12 o'clock and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay. Today, during Radio 3's Baroque Spring, there's another chance to hear a guest talking to Michael about her particular passion for Baroque music.
If you're familiar with the detective work of Commissario Brunetti of Venice, then you'll know the crime novels of Donna Leon, my guest today. Actually, your novels reveal an interest in music, Donna, but very passionately a certain area of music. Is that fair?
I must confess, yes.
Describe that area and how it is defined.
It is named Baroque and needs no description. It speaks for itself.
And it doesn't venture much further, does it?
No, it doesn't, nor do I.
Well, why do you think it is that it's you have such a strong passion for that period?
I don't know. I have no idea. I think it's an irrational attraction, no more discernible or understandable than why someone likes a particular kind of wine or cheese or some sort of physical sensation. Mm. It's just there.
And it's very much guided by voices and vocal writing, isn't
Absolutely,
it?
Yes. I listen to the orchestral music, but I much prefer the voices.
And again, you have quite strong feelings about them.
I have strong preferences, but because I'm not a musician and I have no musical background whatsoever, I'm really the well-listened, ignorant person, and I make no claim to be anything but that.
Mm. How did you first discover music, then?
Very much in the way that Paul was converted to Christianity on the road to Damascus. I was working in New York in the 60s, and one night, for no better reason than that I had nothing better to do, I got a ticket in standing room at the Old Met and went and saw Zinka Milanov sing Tosca. And if the heavens had opened, it couldn't have been more of a stunning experience to me. And I was in that instant converted. I wouldn't cross the street. Well, I'm lying. I backslid a couple of weeks ago and went and saw Tosca and loved it. But I wouldn't listen to Tosca more than once every 10 years or so, the same with Puccini. But I did my homework. I went through them all.
Too sentimental, romantic, or what?
Yeah, a little bit too gooey and melodramatic. I think much of the music is as cheaply melodramatic as the plots are. But when I see them, I love them. Mm. I cannot see Butterfly dry-eyed. I am a sobbing jelly at the end of Butterfly.
You like the classical lines, though, when it's repeated hearing?
Yes.
And the first one, well, you've got two pieces of Handel, actually, and three pieces, and different singers, too.
He does sneak in, doesn't he?
He does. And the first one is a countertenor, and one who's really helped to redefine the role of the countertenor.
Yes. I think there's a kind of masculinity in his voice and in his presence, which in the past has not been as noticeable. I can't say it was lacking, but it certainly isn't noticeable in someone like James Bowman or Christopher Robson, in the voice, not in the person. Mm. But I think in Daniels there's a combination of his presence on stage, which is very, very strong, and that sense in the voice that this is a man singing rather than a human of some sex later to be determined.
And do you prefer this to Scholl, even?
I'm of two minds about that. I like Scholl because I find him a more sophisticated singer, a more subtle singer than Daniels. And I've seen them both in performance a number of times, but I would put my money down on Daniels because I think he's more persuasive with what he does. I think Scholz has a voice for a connoisseur.
But perhaps you would prefer Scholl in Bach cantatas and
yes.
Daniels in Handel, as we're going to hear him now. And what is it you've chosen?
This is Vivi Tirano from Rodilinda. He's forgiving a tyrant and telling him that he may live. Vivi Tirano.
Scampato, sveglio.
I must say that phrase, which reminds me very much of a little bit of Mendelssohn. Dum, ba-da-dum, ba-da-dum, bum, bum. That was, however, Handel, Vivi Tirano from Rodelinda. David Daniels sang Betterido with the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, conducted by Sir Roger Norrington. It does have a muscular vigour, doesn't it, the voice?
It does. And in the countertenors who have been famous until now and who have recorded, I don't think that quality is present. I think this accounts for the kind of legitimacy which the countertenor voice is gaining, primarily because of Daniels. Because he's such a big man and such a seemingly macho man. And usually countertenors are other than that. And I think that anything that can be done to make people who are not Baroque nuts see this as a not weird, freaky voice is all to the good.
Well, it's the voice of Cecilia Bartoli now in Vivaldi. What are the differences here? What are the qualities that draw you to this performance?
I like the passion of it. And the fact that everyone jumps on Bartoli because she has a small voice. So does Daniels. I've seen him in performance a number of times, and it's a small voice. So is hers. I think she uses it wonderfully, wonderfully well. And I think with this particular disc, she's done every one of us, of the faithful, a service, in that she has managed to produce a Baroque single disc that has sold remarkably well. I don't know how many hundred thousands of discs this has sold, but it's kind of a phenomenon in the recording industry that a disc as arcane as this, with this kind of literally unrecorded music, could so much have appealed to the popular taste. It's absolutely phenomenal, and I think the answer lies in the intrinsic beauty of the music, which appeals to the listening ear of anyone, I think, and to this absolutely exquisite voice.
Do you think that using music, either whether it's the three tenors or whether it's Mozart and Elvira Madigan, do you think it matters if it's allied to some other kind of form, if you like? I mean, as long as it gets the music to a wider audience, is presumably what matters most.
No, I don't think it matters, but I think that the quality of the music performed does matter. And I think that the quality of music performed by the three tenors is criminal. I think that they have been criminally and contemptuously disregarding of any canon of good singing, of good taste. I can't despise those records more, or them for having done it. But the bottom line in the music business today, as you probably know far better than I, is the buck, making a buck. And they've made millions and millions of bucks for their companies with these discs. But the level of singing is the kind of stuff that I hope in their later years it will keep them awake at night with shame.
Well, this one you think won't, because it actually happily marries quality and
this is
and
quite the contrary. Yeah, this, given the sea of junk that's out there and becomes popular, this disc is miraculous in that it's very, very good and very, very popular, because you don't see a lot of them, particularly in Baroque music.
And just tell us roughly what's happening here.
It's in Tamerlano. She's one of the minor characters, and she is singing an aria that is saying that the sea is going to swallow us, is going to take us over.
Oh,
It's nice to know that Vivaldi wrote something other than the Four Seasons, isn't it?
Well, that's the other wonderful thing about that disc, of course, is, I mean, it's the singing and the quality of the music, but also discovering those some of those operatic arias by Vivaldi.
Mm-hmm. There's an archive full of them in Torino. The FOA archive has hundreds of unexplored and certainly unrecorded and probably in this century unperformed arias. There's an endless supply, and one hopes that there will be a revival of his operas, because I think they are very dramatic, and I think that they're doable.
We heard Cecilia Bartoli singing that music from Il Tamerlano by Vivaldi, with Il Giardino Armonico, conducted by Giovanni Antonini. It was less than 10 years that you almost accidentally, and in fact in an opera house, began your novelist career, Donna Leon.
Yes. I killed him dead.
Tell us how it happened.
I was in the dressing room of La Fenice, ex La Fenice, with Gabriele Ferro, an old friend of mine, who was conducting there, La Favorita. And he and his wife, both of whom are Sicilian, started talking badly about another conductor, whose name I never reveal, although everyone knows who he was. And we had the usual Italian escalation, and we were immediately thinking how and where would the body be and what signs would there be. And when I went home that evening, I thought, gee, what a great idea that would be for a murder mystery, a book. And I wrote one because I wanted to see if I could. And then it sat in a drawer for 2 years until a friend of mine nagged me, quite literally, into sending it off to a contest in Japan. And it won, and then got a two-contract offer from an American publisher. And then I realized, after I signed the contract, that I had to write a second one. And that's how it started, really as an extended joke.
How do you feel about the difference between writing, say, and musicians and composing and things like that? I mean, is there a huge gap in your view?
Well, yeah, and I think that's what produces the tremendous envy I feel for musicians, because those of us who fool around with words have always got to have that lapsus between what we write and what people perceive, or what people read and what they perceive. There's that seconds gap where they have to transform it into idea. But you guys just go right to the heart, and there's no gap, there's no hesitation. You just buzz right in, whether it's a composer of music or a voice. And I think your power is divine.
And yet the interesting thing is that it's done through something which is essentially abstract. I mean, that's the conundrum,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yes. It's without thought. Music doesn't convey a thought. We've attributed, oh, this is sad music, this is happy music. Whether that's instinctive in us, I don't know. But there's no words and there's no ideas. But there's so much feeling. You can get us to march off the end of the earth like lemmings. And I don't think that words can do that.
Now, I think this next piece of music you've chosen partially as an example of how possibly one might not do it.
This is an example of how one definitely wouldn't do it. This is Filippo Giordano, who is one of the raving divas of Italian popular music. And Filippo has chosen to record an album on which there are a number of arias. Unlike Michael Bolton, who recorded a similar series of arias some years ago, Miss Giordano does sing in what is discernibly Italian, the one virtue of this disc.
Looking at the sleeve, where she's sort of slightly Leslie Caron-like,
yes,
look at the front, and then stretched out long ways,
yes,
in the middle, one sort of has the feeling that this might be more about her than about the music.
Yes, and I think there's less to say about Filippo than there is to say about Casta Diva.
Thank you.
Well, amongst the large number of people who receive copious expressions of gratitude on the back of the sleeve, your name, Donna Leon, is conspicuous by its absence.
Oh.
But so clearly this record has pleased a lot of Italians. It sold quite
Absolutely. Well. Absolutely. It sold very, very well. Yes.
I suppose it's right, but I don't think we've had it before, really, that somebody on Private Passions should choose something which they feel passionate hatred about. But there we are.
It's only time. I think the only recording that could follow this in similar quality would be something like maybe O.J. Simpson singing Otello.
Well, we have got something later on, just to keep everybody
just
up
as good,
to scratch.
Yes.
We heard Casta Diva from Norma.
No, we didn't.
You would doubt if you'd recognise this song, by Bellini. Arranged, orchestrated and conducted by someone who perhaps should have kept his name off it, Celso Valli. And, of course, the singer was Filippa Giordano. Well, we move on to something now which is pretty sublimely different. But all this has irritated some people in some ways. I mean, some purists wouldn't necessarily like the way René Fleming sings Handel.
Yeah. A lot of people that I've spoken to have criticized the flagrant romanticism of her interpretation. Yeah, it's not what is today thought to be proper Handelian singing style. But who cares? It is, I find it a ravishing performance. I saw it in Paris. I went to Paris to see this performance. And at the end of the opera, there was a moment of stunned silence on the part of everyone in the house, because the whole thing was of a quality that I've seldom heard in years.
So what you're saying really is that it is permissible to bring a different technique to something,
yes,
as long as the quality you bring transcends, if you like.
Yes, and I think Filippa does not transcend, but this does.
And what aria is this? Which aria from?
Ombre Pallide. This is Alcina's big aria at the end of the second act, when she realizes that her magic, because she has seduced a man by magic, her magic doesn't work anymore, and she breaks her magic wand and she sings to her pale shadows to bring back her magic powers.
Thank you.
Music from Handel's Alcina, Ombre Pallide, sung by René Fleming with Les Arts Florissants, conducted by William Christie. How was it, Donna Leon, that you came to live in Venice?
After I'd finished graduate school, I went in 60-something and fell in love with it the way one does. And then luckily I made Venetian friends the time after that when I went back in the late 60s. Two of them, a married couple. And I always went back to visit them, and then I started to stay with them, and I'd go back and see them two or three times a year. And then in 80, when I decided that I would finally settle down, because I'd been roaming all over the world for about 20 years, I decided to go and settle where most of the people that I loved and knew well were. It would be nice to be able to say it was an aesthetic and artistic decision, but it was a completely emotional decision. They were there, so I went there.
And of course, it gave you a wonderful setting for your stories, but it is actually fairly crime-free from the point
yes,
of view of just living there.
It is. It's becoming more and more crime-filled, as is the rest of Italy, with the change in population.
And of course, the worst crime probably for somebody living there is the tourists.
You said that, I didn't.
Mozart next, and the extraordinary thing about this is that it's written by somebody 14 years old.
14 years old. And the sensibility that he displays in the vocal writing and in the emotions. These are emotions that usually 14-year-old boys don't know about because they're out playing basketball or soccer.
Where do you think it comes from?
Genius. God. Both of which he is, I think.
It gives you an opportunity to hear Cecilia Bartoli again.
Yeah. And Nathalie Dessay, who I think is an equally skilled singer.
What are they singing about here?
This is one of those opera seria set pieces. We can't live together, so let's die together.
Thank you.
If I cannot live, if you too must die, my idol, let me at least die with you. Music from Mitridate, Re di Ponto by Mozart, Cecilia Bartoli and Nathalie Dessay, with Les Talents Lyriques, conducted by Christophe Rousset. Well, we finally persuaded you, Donna Leon, after a little bit of arm-twisting, to move into the tenor or bass clef, and also just a little bit beyond the Baroque.
Yes. I checked the testosterone chart. I stuck the testosterone thermometer in all of the discs on the wall, and I said, by God, Jussi Björling and Di Quella Pira.
Right. And it's from Il Trovatore. What is it you like about this?
Well, it's breathless and unbeatable and exciting, and Manrico's going to tell the story of that funeral pyre from which he was pulled. I haven't heard this in 20 years. And it's Björling, and what a voice. I'm very glad that you insisted, because it gave me great joy to listen to this. I had forgotten.
Too bad, was it?
Oh, it was glorious. Jussi, where are you when we need you?
And it was the shortest piece you had on,
I didn't want to overdo this first time.
No, didn't get an overdose of it. Jussi Björling has Manrico in Di Quella Pira from Il Trovatore by Verdi, the Robert Shaw Chorale and the RCA Victor Orchestra, conducted by Renato Cellini, a recording made in 1952. As I said, it was the shortest piece you've had, and it's even shorter than the next piece you've got, which has also incurred your wrath to some extent, Donna Leon.
This is a great singer. This is the remains of a great singer. And the voice is still a beautiful voice, but I don't know, in this politically correct time, one can't say things like this, but what is someone with a voice like this doing making this recording? I don't know. I just don't know what purpose.
Well, it's kind of aesthetic prostitution, isn't it?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I just can't say that about someone who I admire so absolutely for the years of great singing that she gave us. I just don't know why someone would do this.
But nevertheless, that is what it is, because it's sort of, I mean, it is that thing of hearing great singers doing musicals, and one wants to hear that as little as one wants to hear musical singers singing great operas.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, tell us what it is.
It's one of the Maori songs sung by Dame Curie, and it was in conjunction, or it was released in conjunction with her singing as part of the Millennium Spectacle, where when the sun first, blah, blah, blah.
That magnificent spectacle.
I didn't see it.
You're lucky. No, the fireworks were very good. The rest of it left on.
There's no fireworks here.
Well, here we are, Kiri Te Kanawa. I mean, I suppose there is some ancestral reason for singing this.
Yes. But I don't know whether this sounds like... I've never heard Maori songs, but I'm not sure that if one went to the outback and listened to Maori songs that they would have this precise orchestration.
Yes, and it's called the Abbey Road Ensemble, for that makes one wonder whether there's a...
Abbey Road,
another,
Wellington.
Venue of that type in the outback. Well, let's listen and see what we think. Well, there are a lot of Maori musicians involved, so who's to say that's not authentic? But there's something strange about it.
I saw her and heard her sing The Countess in New York, and I just can't. I can't.
I thought it's interesting that she, too, is stretched out rather languorously, like Philippa.
It's what sells.
On the sleeve, which
but this,
our
this
listeners are spared.
Flies out of the stores. They can't keep this on the shelves.
Well, maybe it helps to subsidise performances of The Countess. That's the only
maybe
way of looking
it does.
At it.
Maybe it does.
And maybe when you go to New Zealand, you'll find that that's exactly how it sounds.
I'm sure.
And then you'll have to go down on your knees and grovel. We heard that traditional Maori tune sung by Kirita Kanawa and a Maori group, as well as the Abbey Road Ensemble. You're going to finish with, as you began, Donna Leon, your perhaps most consistent passion, Handel.
Yeah, this is the final chorus from Saul, one of the great oratorios. It's one of those shake 'em up, thank God it's all over, give thanks to the Lord. It's very, to me, it's very much like the ending of the occasional oratorio, just the bang it out, thanks to God, and lets everybody go home happy. Mm. Nobody knew how to draw something to a close the way he did. Thank you.
Gird On Thy Sword from Handel's Saul, the Vienna State Opera Chorus and Concertos Musicus of Vienna, conducted by Nicolas Arnoncourt. Well, Donna Leon, that brings us to the end of your choice. I notice you didn't venture into the 20th century. Do you not have much sympathy with 20th century music?
I don't have much sympathy with 20th century anything, I must confess, except perhaps dentistry. I just don't like it. I don't like its writing much. I don't like its art much. I don't like its music much.
Would you rather go to the dentist than listen to it?
If it were a 20th century dentist. I'd never rather go to the dentist, but I just feel much more at home in every sense in the 18th century.
Well, thank you very much for a fascinating tour through a gallery of voices and singing. And those of our listeners who would like to explore more of the adventures of Commissario Brunetti can read your novel, Friends in High Places. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Donna Leon was talking to Michael Barclay. That programme was originally broadcast in May 2000. Private Passions is produced for Radio 3 by Classic Arts, with studio production by Martin Cotton. Next week on Private Passions, there's another chance to hear Michael talking to the historian Amanda Vickery. That's at the same time next Sunday, midday.
Folk songs have been with us forever, but these days you're as likely to hear them in a concert hall as out in the fields and towns where they began. If you want to get a sense today of the earthy power of this music, I think you can't do any better than hear them sung by a choir. I'm Mary King, and in Radio 3's The Choir this week, I want to share with you some of my favourite choral works inspired by traditional folk music. From the airs and dances of Eastern Europe to the ancient melodies of the British Isles, I'll be exploring how composers like Janáček, Kodály, Holst and Vaughan Williams created masterpieces from the stories, songs and soil of their native lands. That's The Choir with me, Mary King, this afternoon at 5 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, there's more from our Baroque Spring in just a couple of minutes in today's early music show. Lucy Skeeping explores the relationship between Rameau and his main patron. If you've recently tuned in, a very good afternoon to you from me, Jonathan Swain. It's 1 o'clock. A summary of the news now. The Department for Work and Pensions says it will fight any attempt by bishops in the House of Lords to overturn government plans to cap increases in welfare payments. The new Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, has backed an open letter by more than 40 bishops who say the measure will drive families and children into poverty. They've tabled an amendment to the welfare bill, which is due to be debated in the Lords next week. Nick Clegg has suffered a defeat at the Liberal Democrat Spring Conference in Brighton, which has overwhelmingly opposed legislation to allow evidence in some civil court cases to be heard in secret. One party activist, a lawyer, Jo Shaw, said she was resigning her membership in protest at the plans. In the past hour, Mr. Clegg has been delivering his main speech to the conference. He urged the Lib Dems to build on the success of the Eastleigh by-election, saying they had secured victory as a party of government, not a party of protest. The president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, has accused the Taliban and the US government of working together to convince Afghans violence will increase if most foreign troops leave as planned at the end of next year. He said recent suicide attacks, which the Taliban said they'd carried out, were aimed at prolonging the international military presence in Afghanistan. Police in the Pakistani city of Lahore say they've arrested dozens of people after more than 100 homes in a Christian neighbourhood were ransacked and set on fire yesterday. The trouble began after it was alleged that a Christian man had made blasphemous remarks about the Prophet Muhammad. There have been demonstrations against the attacks in Lahore and in the capital, Islamabad. The polls have opened in the Falkland Islands, where people are voting in a referendum on whether the territory should remain British. The islanders decided to hold the vote in response to Argentine pressure for negotiations over sovereignty. And the weather, sleet and snow in central areas will spread southwards this afternoon. It'll be generally windy and very cold. BBC News and weather at just after 2 minutes past one. Well, now on Radio 3, our Baroque spring season continues with the early music show's French Baroque focus. Here's Lucy Skeeping.
Towards the end of his life, Jean-Philippe Rameau would leave his large suite of rooms in Rue des Bons Enfants every day to take a walk in the nearby gardens of the Palais Royal, or Tuileries. He was always alone and usually lost in thought. Sometimes he would meet the young writer Chabanon, who later noted down some of the old composer's disillusioned, confidential remarks. "Day by day, I'm acquiring more good taste," Rameau is reported to have said, "but I no longer have any genius." That's quite surprising to hear, because we know that Rameau's late years were actually very successful and productive, and a period in his life which coincided with his meeting his most important patron, Alexandre Le Riche de la Pouplinière.